In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Government isn't the solution to your problems. Government is the problem. It turns out there's good money to be made in causing problems. It's like a dangerous intersection with blind spots in multiple directions, but no one put a stop sign there. Now, the obvious answer is to put up a stop sign, or a traffic light, or at least a caution sign. But why do that when you can make money off a problem? You need to fund a study to discover the problem, a problem that everyone already knows what the problem is. The study finds that the problem is there are cars on the road. Well, we could put up a stop sign, but which traffic has to stop? And are there particular cars that crash more often than other cars? Well, now we need more studies. And once those studies study the problem, there's another problem. Do we yet know the problem causing the problem? Did I mention those studying the problem happen to be big, profitable, nonprofit think tanks, taking millions from the government, who just happen to have affiliated nonprofit organizations that are also highly profitable because they hire activists to point out the problems and push government to fund the studies that study problems that hire activists to point out the problems? See the problem? But after enough studies study the problem and determine that there is a problem, there's another problem. Does government have the statutory authority to fix the problem? Well, there's a problem. We don't have a law letting us fix the problem, despite the fact the government caused the problem by not putting up a sign when they built the roads. So, we just have a new round of paid activists to demand government fix the problem, which it does by pulling out those roads and building new ones somewhere else. That's a lot of money spent that doesn't need to be spent. And if you think that's fictitious, it's really not. That's the state of modern governance, because somewhere along the road, the administrative state discovered they could spend taxpayer dollars on politically aligned activism, whose real job is to keep up the appearance that more government is needed, not more effective and more efficient government is needed, the way you'd run a business. The administrative state also discovered that taxpayers are not activists, because they're too busy working, paying taxes. And they really don't complain how badly their money is wasted. And, get this, they not only don't complain how badly bureaucrats waste the taxes that they pay every year, bureaucrats can also go out and borrow 2 or 3 or 10 times what taxpayers pay, and they still won't complain. And here's the real kicker. No matter how much bureaucrats spend or completely waste taxpayers' money, they can't be fired. No one can be or will be held responsible for colossal wastes of taxpayer money. And they get a lifetime pension to boot, funded by you, the taxpayer. Welcome to modern governance. There is no money to be had in solving problems. There is a lot of money in creating problems and never solving the problems you created. But I do think that we are on the verge of this beginning to change, because finally people are beginning to wake up to what's happening. They've decided to not be silent anymore, and that's what's been needed for all of these years. It's a long road ahead, but a journey that needs to be made. And I believe we're just now taking the first steps. I'd like to welcome Jim Huggins to the show, who is currently running to be Republican candidate for governor of Oregon. Jim, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Mark. I appreciate it. It's a real pleasure to be here with you guys.
Sure. And, you know, as always, we like to get to know people a little bit. And your work background has almost as much variety as the Help Wanted section. You were a decorated U.S. Air Force officer, ended up at the Pentagon, took a command post in Iraq during Desert Storm, and then later went to Africa. You went into the private sector to work at tech startups, worked in the transportation industry, got a master's in engineering and then a PhD in engineering. You taught at Campbell University at the U.S. Air Force, worked in the film industry as an actor, director, and producer, and you're an author. And most recently, you picked up a Doctor of Divinity, and you're an ordained pastor. So did you just keep getting fired there, or what's the story?
No, God had a really interesting path for me to follow that. At the time I was going through everything, each of these different opportunities, I just felt like a pinball in a pinball machine. Mm. But in reality, when we formed New Shepherd Films a little over 12 years ago and I stepped on set for our first film, I looked over my shoulder, and he had prepared me for everything I needed to do, and it was basically a straight line right to where I was. What I wasn't fully aware of at the time is that what he was really preparing me for was the leadership and management and communications challenges associated with being the governor of a state like Oregon. You have got to be able to demonstrate true leadership, not political leadership, and we can get into the differences in that in a little bit. But everything I've done has been basically leading me right here. I didn't realize it at the time, but I certainly do now.
Well, you know, that actually takes a lot of courage and confidence to make that many radical career changes. Where does that courage and confidence come from? Was it learned or something that you inherited?
Well, that is a great question. I've never really thought about that. I guess if I step back and look at it, try to look at it objectively, it probably comes from three different sources. Number one is simply faith. A lot of this is you walk by faith, not by sight. The second part of it, more than likely, I would attribute to my grandfather. I was raised by my grandfather. I lost my mom when I was five. So much of what I do is attributed to the work ethic and the quiet confidence that he exuded in everything that he did. From being a judge to running an orphanage and raising over 500 kids over a 35-year period, wow. You name it. So a lot of who and what I am, I attribute to my grandfather. Without him, I promise you, I would not be here. But probably the third aspect has been learned. I have been in some remarkable positions and opportunities that I simply took advantage of. I looked at it and said, this, you know, youth is kind of an interesting place to be sometimes. So when I was young, I'd look at situations, oh, this looks cool. Let's do this. Let's see what happens. And in all of those cases, I wound up being in positions where I not only learned, but was also mentored and tutored by some of the best in that particular area. So it all has culminated from a combination of things.
Well, that's really cool, and we'll dig into your education and some other background in the next segment or so,
sure.
But since it's Veterans Day week, let's start with your military career as an officer in the U.S. Air Force. What would you like our audience to know about that and how it would make you a stronger governor than someone without that experience?
Well, I can tell you this. I started out as an E-2, which is an airman first class, and made it to E-5, went through officer training school, and was commissioned a second lieutenant. I'm currently a lieutenant colonel. And those steps are not easy ones to take. They constantly try you in terms of your dedication, your resolve. But you look at it and you take it from the standpoint of you got to learn from every aspect of that. And leadership is obviously key within the military service. And what a lot of people don't realize is that we've had some phenomenal leaders out there who taught you how to lead and look at perspective, look at situations from a perspective of what's the right thing to do. It's not just a matter of following orders. A good example of that would be when I was on the battle staff of the U.S. Central Command. We had a situation come up where, you know, we needed to take out a particular target, and it was a very challenging operation. And the requirement was to minimize collateral damage. In other words, you don't get anybody or any damage done around the target. You only take out just that particular piece of your enemy's capabilities. Came up with a great plan. The commander leaned back in his chair when it was briefed and just looked at everybody and said, well, that's great. Love it. What time's the cleaning crew go home? And that right there, when you have a four-star in the middle of a battle, looking at you, wanting to know when the cleaning crew goes home, and he was asked why that was important, and the answer was, because I'm willing to bet they have either kids or grandkids or both that would like to see them again. That puts a human face on incredible conflict, and I can tell you that as a governor, that is absolutely a required skill. You have got to be able to put a human face on the challenges before you. And Oregon has a number of challenges up one side and down the other, from our economy, from our rioting in Portland, the homelessness, our education challenges, the absolutely out of control violence that's going on, criminal violence. You've got to be able to put a human face on that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, we'll have more with Dr. Lieutenant Colonel Jim Huggins about Jim Huggins. He's running for the Republican nomination for governor here in Oregon, and we'll find out what he thinks about some of the issues facing Oregon. Stay with us. Jim Huggins is seeking the Republican nomination for Oregon's governor. He is a decorated U.S. Air Force, along with a wide and extensive background in engineering and tech startup companies, teaching, holds two doctorates, and is currently president and CEO of New Shepherd Films. You can find out more about him by heading to his campaign site, makegovernmentdowhatitssupposedtodo.com. And to make that easy to find, we'll put it up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And Jim, I'd like to ask you about that. Your current job is the president and CEO of New Shepherd Films. That's an independent film production company. You guys produce faith and family entertainment for the mainstream market. The best stories, of course, have lots of twists and turns, and many of them very unexpected. So how did your path go from military to engineer to film producer?
Well, it was quite a ride, and unfortunately, I don't think we have all the time to relay the entire story, but let me just put it to you simply. My wife and play director, theater director conspired, and I never saw it coming. I got talked into auditioning for The Sound of Music, and I said, okay, I'll audition for an extra. Just stick me on the back wall and be done with it. Well, that's not what happened. I got cast in the lead role as Captain Von Trapp. Little problem with that. I don't sing and I don't dance. And I tried to tell him, you put me in this thing, I'm gonna turn it into a comedy farce. Well, long story short, I learned that you don't have to be able to sing and dance. What you have to be able to do is learn how to act like you can sing and dance. That's the key. Apparently, I was successful at doing that and wound up being, I don't know, I guess the term might be discovered. I had the opportunity to wind up and attend an acting conservatory in Dallas. Before I knew it, I was learning how to direct for film and act on film, and I enjoyed stage productions, and wound up realizing that if you can tell stories, particularly if you are a Christian, you need to tell stories. Hmm. If you can act, you need to act. If you can conduct business as a Christian, you need to do that. You need to be involved in the culture, not keep your light to yourself and sit off in the corner or create a subculture like happens so frequently. What you need to do is you need to take those talents and you need to try to share them with the rest of the world, to the best of your ability anyway. So I founded New Shepherd Films to tell stories, but not to tell stories to the church audience, because that's easy. I can tell a faith-based story to the church audience all day long and twice on Sunday. But it's really important if you can tell those stories of faith to an audience that's really not interested in hearing it, which is why we don't tell stories from the perspective of, a sermon in a box or beating somebody over the head with a scripture. What we try to do is we simply try to tell a true story, because typically truth is stranger than fiction anyway, but we try to tell that true story from a perspective of faith, but from a desired outcome of, and this is real simple, I just want the audience to come away asking one simple question or making one statement. I want to know more. Mm. And that's a home run. Mm. So we have to understand our audience, our purpose and reaction, who we're talking to, why we're talking to them, and when we get done talking, what we want them to do. And fortunately, it's very similar when you're delivering a campaign message. You have to know your audience. You have to understand the issues, and you have to know what you want them to do, which ideally is to vote for you or support you or, whatever. And in this particular case with New Shepherd Films, we've been very successful at being able to identify our audience. And we're extremely successful with the secular or the non-faith-based market. As I said, we can hit a home run with our home crowd. But the trick is, if you're going to win, you got to be able to win on the road. And we've been quite fortunate at that.
Well, some of Jesus's best stories were told not to the believers, but to the non-believers. So
Exactly. Yeah, they're called parables, and that's what we try to do is use a parabolistic style. As I said, we don't want to beat you over the head with a scripture. I just want to present a different perspective and have you go, I want to know more about that.
Well, that's really cool. So you are running for governor, and we'd like to talk about some of the issues here in Oregon. The Portland riots, there were over 100 days of chaos and violence and some 900 arrests that the Multnomah DA just said, meh, just let them go. It's only people's lives and businesses. And I know that the riots were one of the major reasons you said enough was enough and you decided to run for governor. So had you been governor at the time, how would you have handled the riots?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, it's always easy to be an armchair quarterback, but to start with, the very first thing is let's take a look at what's the primary job of the governor. The governor's top job is to make you safe, is to make the government keep you safe, prevent or not prevent, but to create a safe environment. Okay, the governor's number one job, make you safe. That's done by enforcing the laws. The governor doesn't have the option of picking and choosing which laws to enforce. That's not right. That's actually discrimination under the law. That's just not right. So as governor, when I see the citizens being hurt, I see their businesses being hurt, especially law enforcement, oh my gosh, all right, that's absolutely insane what's been going on there. So when I see that, you have to contact the people that are in charge. Well, that's the mayor, the city council, and so forth, and say, excuse me, what is going on in your city? You need to get that under control. Because if you don't, I will. So step one is to actually contact the people that are in the local community that are responsible for enforcing the law. That's their job, and you hold them accountable. Well, failing that, you have to step in and do their job for them because you're watching your own citizens, whom you represent, be hurt, in some cases killed, and you see their businesses being destroyed, and you're watching your state basically on fire. What happened and what evolved ultimately was what I call urban warfare. To me, it looked just like what happened in Mogadishu, Somalia, where you've got small groups of, and bands under different warlords tearing the place apart. Well, we had that in Portland, and I never imagined I'd see that. So the first thing you do is you roll in the state police. State police are the next level of defense against this in terms of enforcing the law. I would also work with or make every effort to work with the local sheriffs in order to establish law and order. And then, ultimately, and this is not the preferred, not the desired, and certainly the last option I would ever want to do, but I would mobilize our National Guard. We would go in with the National Guard to establish what is called in the Constitution domestic tranquility. We would establish peace. And then we'd start sorting out what needed to happen in order to hold the accountability. Once you've done the arrest, you then have to do the prosecutions.
Well, it's funny because how when you don't hold people accountable, they just keep doing it. And that's exactly what we saw with Portland. There's no reason that should have gone on for 100 flipping days. Let's go and take a break there. Coming back, we'll have more with Jim Huggins. He is seeking the Republican nomination for governor. You can find out more about him and his candidacy by heading to makegovernmentdowhatitssupposedtodo.com. Stay with us. Air Force veteran, author, filmmaker, theologian, PhD, educator, and entertainment executive Jim Huggins has held a variety of successful careers. He is now looking to become Oregon's first Republican governor in over three decades. Jim, you hold two doctorates. You've got a PhD in engineering management, specializing in computer and software engineering. You also hold a Doctor of Divinity. And on top of all that, you've completed postgraduate studies in leadership, politics, international relationships, management, communications, physics, technology, space systems, planning, and project management. So clearly, academics and education is very important to you. Like any normal person, we were absolutely stunned that Oregon's governor, who is of course, she heads the education department now. We were stunned that she had removed the graduation requirement that students demonstrate proficiency in math, reading, and writing in an effort to help students of color. You know, when you reach that bottom, it is not about kids failing schools. It is about our entire education system failing kids. So how do we fix Oregon's education system?
Yeah, I as a dad, you know, we have three kids. We've got two boys that are, one's a junior, one's a senior in high school here in Salem. Our daughter has graduated. She's off on, she's 22. She lives up in Portland, but we were stunned, although I have to admit I wasn't terribly surprised, that maybe I should have been, at that insane decision. Equity versus equality is an argument that never wins. When you're at the bottom of the list in terms of education, I honestly thought that it couldn't get any worse. But, you know, by removing that requirement to not show proficiency in reading, writing, and arithmetic, she dug a hole for a basement and shoved us in it and didn't even put a ladder in to help us get out. That's just, I think it's asinine. So I think in terms of solutions, there's a number of things. Number one, the head of Oregon's education has to be removed from the governor's office. Mm-hmm. An actual head of education needs to be established. Someone who is gifted at education and understands the issues K through 12 for educating. That has to be established. That person has to be put in position of authority. And fortunately, I got somebody in mind for that, but I'm not at liberty to discuss that right at the moment. But it's one of those critical issues that you've got to have a solution day one whenever you step into office. That's one of them that we do have. At least I think I've got a really good handle on that one. The other thing is we have to establish curriculums that we go back to standards based. You've got to be able to demonstrate you can meet certain standards in order to earn a certain level of authority in those standards. If you can't, then you go back and you work with that student. You don't just say, well, it's okay, you tried. No. When's the last time you went to a doctor, maybe you had to have surgery, and you looked up at that certificate on the wall, and you go, you know, God, I hope he actually had to demonstrate he knew how to work with a scalpel. I mean, really? Think about it. It's absolutely ridiculous. So we need standards based. We need to have someone actually in charge of this, and we need to be able to work to establish choice. We've got to have school choice. We've got to allow the parents back into the educational system. If parents aren't involved, my gosh, you are just relying on the state, and we've already seen what the state does, so I don't think that's a very good option. You've got to let the kids be instructed and worked with by their parents first and foremost. That's the parents' responsibility, not the state's.
Yes.
And yes, by the way, before you ask the question, let me give you the answer. The money does need to follow that student.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. $14,000 per kid, and you get zero results. I mean, that's just asinine from any standpoint. So
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just look at it from a business standpoint. You throw $10 billion at something over the past 2 years, and you are no better off. I'm sorry. From a pure business standpoint, it's the same thing we're doing with
that's
homelessness.
Exactly right.
That is a failure.
Oh, absolutely.
That's an F.
Absolutely. I imagine that the Republican victories at all levels of government all across the U.S. this last Tuesday had to be pretty encouraging to you. And we've been hearing a lot of here in Oregon, anything is better than what we've got now. But will Oregonians vote for a Republican? And in particular, how and why will non-affiliated voters and independents and Democrats
right.
be attracted to vote for you?
Well, Oregon actually is not a blue state. We're a blue state in our legislature, but we're not a blue state whenever we deal with statewide ballot initiatives. We deal with statewide ballot initiatives, whether it was Measure 11 or whether we're dealing with bloated property taxes, we're dealing with driver's licenses for illegal aliens, you name it. We vote red statewide and generally by a large margin. But Republican candidates don't use these topics in their campaigns. They actually run as Democrat lights.
Yes.
Newt Bueller's perfect example of that.
Yes,
he had
indeed.
Everything he needed to win, and he lost because he used a Democrat light strategy. You cannot win a conflict if all you can do is be like your enemy.
Yeah,
okay?
Because why would they vote for you when they can get the real thing?
Exactly. So in this particular case, you identify those issues, such as the riots, such as the criminal aspects that's going on in our state, homelessness, education. You identify those issues that relate to the family, that relate to the core values of Oregonians, regardless of party. These are core values to society. You relate to those and establish those as your key points and understand that those are the ones that people truly care about. And, oh, by the way, the opposition's on the wrong side of those issues. That is how you not only get your Republican votes, that's how you also are focusing on non-affiliated. It's also how you worry about the conservative Democrats, because they have demonstrated, and our data proves it,
yes.
time and time
yep.
again, that they will support family-oriented issues. And that is what we stand for.
Mm. In your campaign literature, you say that you're not a politician, and that was one of the things that made Trump successful and very appealing. He wanted to run
yes.
government like a business, which it should and,
right.
and which he did start to do. But not being a politician in some ways was also his downfall, in that he assumed that those in government would be on would eventually get on board because, well, he's the president and they're Americans and they work for the government. But instead, he was routinely sabotaged and undermined by the bureaucrats. If elected, how would you, a non-politician, handle the political and bureaucratic world?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And the simple fact of this situation, yes, I agree. There are a lot of aspects we need to look at from a business perspective, i.e., are we investing the taxpayers' dollars wisely and effectively and that sort of thing. But more importantly, you have to work with the personalities. You have to work with people. That's the fundamental basis of leadership. You don't lord over somebody, and that's a lot of what the Democrats are doing, and I refuse to do that. This needs to be far more along the lines of working with people, finding a common ground, and executing those solutions that you come together on. However, you come together on the issues for your campaign platform, which are the ones that affect people. We don't compromise on the ones that are absolutely wrong and hurt people. I'm not going to continue to throw money at education when clearly the path we've been on is wrong. We're going to have to adjust that.
So you have to work with people. Yep, something's got to be fixed. Okay, unfortunately, we're up against the break here, but Jim, I think we'll definitely have to have you back.
I would love it, and I appreciate that very much.
There's some new global warming garbage out there that needs to be debunked, and to do that, I'd like to welcome Chuck Weiss back to the show. Chuck is a trained scientist, meteorologist, and a fierce debunker of junk science. Chuck, it's great to talk to you again.
Glad to be back, Mark.
So we want to have you on because despite spending billions and soon to be trillions of dollars, gosh, the Earth just keeps having climate, which it has done pretty much since the beginning of time. But recently, the Statesman Journal ran a big marketing piece, and one really doesn't need to go any further than the title of the article, "Climate Change Now the Main Driver of Wildfire Weather, and the West Has a Front Row Seat." The study published last week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences looks at what's known as the vapor pressure deficit, which basically describes how thirsty the atmosphere is, said one of the authors of the study. And now, Chuck, I'm not a meteorologist, but for that to be true, doesn't that sort of imply that the atmosphere is static and never moves?
Well, it's implying, what they're trying to imply is that the rainfall deficits are causing a water vapor pressure deficit in the atmosphere. And if you lower the vapor pressure, which is its partial pressure of all the total pressure in the air, if you lower that down, you get a gradient if the ground is wet into the dry air and you increase evaporation. So they're saying that if the air is drier to start with, it's going to pull all the available water out of the ground faster than it would if we had a higher vapor pressure, which basically just translates to higher humidity. They like to use these fancy terms that they throw around, and I think they do this partially on purpose to try to confuse the public. So just think of vapor pressure as humidity. It's very similar. So when we have high humidity, the evaporation rates get lower. When we have lower humidity, the evaporation rates become higher. And what they're trying to say is, well, the air is getting drier and drier and drier because of climate change, and therefore any available water in the ground just gets sucked out, making the agricultural problems even worse and blah, 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 blah. Well, of course, if you look at the records of precipitation in California, where they like to focus all this nonsense, you see that there's hardly any change through 100 years of record. Now, there are up years, there are down years, there are even some small trends you could discern in that 100-year record, and they're focusing on the part that goes down, just like people in Oregon have done at Oregon State University. The Oregon Climate Change Research Institute likes to cherry-pick snowfall data to say our glaciers are melting and they're going away, when they only take part of the record to look at it, but if you look at the whole record, there's basically no change. And we're looking at the same thing with this ridiculous paper saying that there's water vapor pressure deficits, and that's adding to the climate problem, adding to the severe drought. That's complete nonsense. There have been some drier years when we went to the warm phase of the PDO, or the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, that started in 1977, and that caused some decline in California's precipitation, but overall, it's pretty close to the 100-year record. So this paper is complete nonsense. They like to cherry-pick a dry year, grab data out of that, and then say, look at this, and compare it to a wet year, but then they don't show the overall trend. The overall trend shows no change in 100 years of records in California. So the whole premise of the paper is complete nonsense. Like so many other things that we have seen these racketeers forward with their climate change nonsense. And just look what they're doing to energy as a result of this fraud. It just makes you want to pull your hair out.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. And I did find this one of the last lines there rather hysterical, and they say the knowledge imparted by the study is powerful because it indicates that human activities play a key role in determining future fire risk. I would say lack of human activities have played a key role in determining fire risk, but she goes on to say that risk could someday be reduced if the world changes trajectories to rely less on fossil fuels. So, Chuck, if no one uses any fossil fuels anywhere, but we allow dead wood to pile a mile high in the forest, it won't burn or cause catastrophic wildfires because no one's using fossil fuels.
Complete nonsense. And a third grader could reason this sort of thing, that would be nonsense. If the forests are not managed properly, and believe me, when these environmental wackos took over and started to manage the forests out of the 1960s, we started seeing all these regulations that prohibited logging, prohibited the removal of old growth forest, and all these fuels have been allowed to build up over time. And so you get a dry year or a year with a lot of thunderstorms, and you're going to get more fires because they didn't manage them properly. The climate is doing nothing. It's doing nothing more than it's done and not done for the last 100 years, as long as we've kept records. But what's changed is the management of these forests.
Yep. Yep.
And I believe that you've had Dr. Bob Zybak on before, who talked about this, who's a forester PhD. He's been on other radio programs too. And he's also an Oregon State alumni like I am. And basically identified these problems beautifully. It's absolute reckless forest management through environmental nonsense that's caused this. Mm-hmm. The weather and the climate have absolutely nothing to do with it.
Yep, absolutely. It is kind of interesting that they're starting to show a little bit of a shift, because they say fire agencies have had to pivot to new ways of fighting and preventing fires in this changed environment. They include everything from adopting new technologies, blah, 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 to redoubling efforts to focus on fuels management and community outreach and education. Hey, Einstein, if you'd done that 20 or even 10 years ago when we're all screaming at you to do it, we wouldn't be in this mess. But I am glad that they finally agree with us. But the problem, of course, is that they waited until there was a massive problem. And now to the manipulated public, it looks like they are responding to climate change rather than what it was, piss poor management. So the uninformed public is left thinking, gosh, climate change must be real. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are exactly what you just outlined, and that's that the climate change fraud has gone on long enough. There are several metrics you can use to show just how fraudulent and unhonest or dishonest this whole thing has been. And that's exactly what they've done. They say we have to act. We must act on climate change. So we're going to do some things now to show that we're fighting it, and we can start managing some of these forests better in terms of fighting climate change. But you're absolutely right. What they're doing without admitting it and talking out of both sides of their mouth is acknowledging there's a problem with their past management practices, and they have to do something about it. The 2020 wildfire season was probably one of the worst we've ever experienced, and it's due completely to their owing their recklessness and their mismanagement of these forests.
Yep. You know what doesn't cause forest fires? Dry wood that isn't there because proper forest management removed it before it could be a problem, no matter how warm or cold the earth is. All right, let's take a break there. Coming up, fraud and creating the problem. Welcome back. We're talking today to Chuck Weiss. He's a former meteorologist and current fearsome global warming critic. And Chuck, I'd like to remind our audience about how the global warming believers have effectively created the problem. And I'm sure that, like you, I have certainly lived through five. The world will end in 10 years if we don't do something. And of course, that's because they've lied every time. Lied to get the money. It's easy to make these apocalyptic predictions when you're the one that collects the data and then change the data when you don't get the temperature data that you want. So back in the 70s, it was a coming ice age, and then reality didn't provide that, so they pivoted to global warming. And even then, they didn't get what they wanted when the 2000s hit. So talk to our audience about how the Church of the Ever-Warming Globe created the problem by manipulating data and temperature readings to what we have now, where every year is the hottest year on record.
Yes, I can start with the idea or the fact that I was a undergrad student at Oregon State University in atmospheric science when this business and transformation to studying the climate actually began. And back then, Mark, they were saying that, well, atmospheric science has conquered the frontier of weather forecasting when we really hadn't. But that's kind of the message that the department chair gave when he came in as a new arrival on campus. And they said, well, we're going to change the entire way we look at atmospheric science. The new frontier is to conquer the climate. We want modelers. Our emphasis is going to be heavy on mathematics. We're going to change the department because that's what we're going to do. We're going to make climate models, which will be able to tell us, just like weather forecast models, what the actual climate will look like, maybe hundreds of years into the future. And back then, all of us who were sitting and listening to this lecture by the new arriving chair were saying to ourselves, well, gee, that's all a noble idea and kind of a neat idea, but we also knew what the severe limitations of trying to do that are, not just mathematically, but physically. And because we knew what the limitations were with even short-range weather forecast models. So when they invented these models, Mark, a lot of people don't understand this, that a climate model is nothing more than a weather forecast model configured to do climate. In other words, make large time integrations into the future. And you have to sacrifice quality in a big sort of way to be able to get that result. And how they were going to overcome those mathematical and physical obstacles were something we were scratching our heads over back then and figured, good luck. You're going to have a lot of work in front of you, and I doubt if you could do it. That was my opinion, you know, back in the 70s. Well, they went ahead and developed an operational climate model. In fact, I think Oregon State was one of the first universities to do it. And so they run the model, and they I didn't know back at the time, by the way, when this was going on, that they were concerned about atmospheric CO2. That wasn't discussed. But later, as the model came out, suddenly we're starting to get all these predictions of a rapidly warming climate based upon the rising CO2 levels. And so the statistical correlation between rising CO2 and their projected temperatures was nearly perfect. And so, in other words, the model was suggesting that the climate was being controlled by CO2. And that really set a lot of us on our ear, because we knew from the founding principles from atmospheric science that CO2 does not drive the climate. It's a greenhouse gas of only secondary significance, and it's water vapor in the hydrological cycle that actually regulate the radiation budget of the Earth. So when they started getting these results, we thought, you know, this is really something. Then all the founding principles must be wrong. That's kind of what I was thinking at the time. But as the time scale moved forward from the time the first model predictions came out, we started to see that the climate wasn't actually conforming to what the models were predicting. There were big discrepancies. And when the time got to the time frame got from the time they first initialized and ran the models, when the temperature diverged to a point in time later on that was so significant from their model predictions, that was alarming to them, because now they would have to admit, if they showed this to the public, that the models are wrong. They can't do what they said they were going to do. They're way off the mark in terms of predicting the global temperature based upon a CO2 input. And so this was very discerning and troubling to the people who ran these programs. And it really boils down to the fact that, well, it was the politicians funding this stuff, this junk science. And they were unhappy with the results. And so they got to the point where they weren't willing to admit they were wrong. Somebody started lying, and the lying became very serious, because they started to manipulate data to conform it to the failed climate models rather than use the historical climate data that we have as the true reflection of the Earth's past climate in areas where we'd actually measured it. So they completely erased some very important things. There were cooling trends that happened in the 70s and in the 1940s that they erased, and what they did was, and I have a study that shows exactly what NOAA did to cause this falsification of the temperature record. They cooled the early part of the record down, and no scientific justification in doing this. And I'm talking about temperature records that go back towards like the year 1900 and the late 1880s, and then from that point up to maybe around 1950 and 60. And beyond that, they started warming the records, and they started doing what we called homogenization of temperature data, where they got rid of rural stations and amplified the effect of urban stations into rural areas to get a warming effect. The net result was they got a completely skewed, alteration of the Earth's temperature record in the areas that they were interested in that showed this conformity to the failed climate models rather than the true climate records. And so, this was horrible.
It's absolutely horrible, and it is completely unscientific. So how did these two bastions of science, what was their excuse for doing that?
They had a number of things that they said. There are some changes to a historical record that can be justified. If they find a thermometer wasn't measuring properly, wasn't conformed to the same standards that the other data sets that they have were, you have to look at records and determine whether any adjustments could be made. But the point was, when they started making their adjustments, the people who were in charge of, and the climatologists who were in charge of their old records, they'd already done this. They'd already made the corrections. Then these guys came along and said, no. We got to make more adjustments to them. But the adjustments they talked about making and what they did are simply not scientific. You can't take a thermometer that's measuring temperature in an urban area and move it out and say it represents a rural area. And that's what they did. When the modernization and restructuring of the Weather Service took place, the Weather Service dropped a lot of the rural stations out of the measuring record, and they only had the urban ones in a lot of cases left. But they still had the station identifications to the rural records, and so this is when people like James Hansen got involved, and they started taking the urban records and backfilling.
Yep.
Rural station yep. data into this to get this warming trend that they wanted.
And of course,
totally dishonest.
And
totally dishonest.
Totally dishonest. And of course, they only skew it one way, where they're
exactly.
only counting the thermometers in cities sitting on hot blacktop or cement, and not adjusting for the other direction as well. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll have more with Chuck Weiss. Coming up, we'll be talking about fossil fuels. If you've listened to the past two segments, you know that Chuck Weiss is a fierce global warming debunker, and we're in our final segment now with him. And Chuck, during the break there, you were mentioning that about weather extremes and some of the things that you were seeing in the Capitol Press. Could you talk to our audience a little bit about that?
Yes, we had, unfortunately, a few people from our own Oregon chapter of the American Meteorological Society make a boneheaded statement to the Capitol Insider that the extreme weather we had last February and the heat wave of June were proof that the climate's changing as climate scientists had warned us about. And that's complete hogwash. The exact opposite is true of that. I did a paper on that, which was published on Dr. Ed Berry's site, that took apart the claims made by Jennifer Francis, which basically were defying the fundamental physics of atmospheric science that point out when the weather gets extreme, you have a large temperature difference across the latitude lines that gets converts potential energy to energy that develops storms. And if the CO2 is changing the climate like these people claim that it's doing, that entire process is weakened, the jet stream migrates to higher latitude, and you get much less severe weather. So if it were true that CO2 was changing the climate, you wouldn't have got that severe ice storm back in February, and you wouldn't have gotten the severe heat wave that we did in June, which, by the way, was solar radiation driven because of its timing with the passage of the solar solar solstice, which was just past June 21st. That was the true cause of all this. Yet those kind of statements are made which are politically self-serving, completely ridiculous, but they're the kind of things that we hear coming out of the mouth of Kate Brown, who is a scientific illiterate and knows nothing, just like these Democrats in the Oregon House and Senate.
Well, they know how much money can be made off of green energy and global warming. Getting back to something that we had said earlier is that if no one is using fossil fuels, then we wouldn't have these wildfires, according to the left. And also in the news, the Biden administration is attempting to shut down a pipeline that goes across Michigan, which could massively decrease the heating oil supply in the northern Midwest while simultaneously increasing the costs due to their artificial shortening. You know, this is, of course, another attempt to make fossil fuels as expensive as green energy, solar and wind. And, you know, we used to put people in jail for manipulating the markets. And now we've got the government seeing how profitable it is for their political allies and for themselves. And I think it's time we make it illegal for anyone, but especially the government, to manipulate markets. And the only way we're going to do that is through elections.
Well, yes, the elections are becoming very important. That's why the first thing that needs to be fixed is the election fraud of 2020, because I think a lot of these people who are in power today, who are ruining this country, absolutely wrecking it with this environmental insanity, are the people that did things like steal the 2020 elections. And I know we're not supposed to talk about this. We're supposed to stick to science, but this is the science has been completely politicized now, where the truth is relative to the flow of money rather than the absolute truth. It's totally disgusting what's happened to these universities, and the whole thing is a mess. It needs to be cleaned up. And while this environmental nonsense gets promoted like it is, take a look at what the politicians who fund this junk science do with this bad data. They are wrecking the country with it by promoting their green agendas. Look at what they're proposing to do to the Oregon electric grid by going to wind and solar and knocking out some essential forms of power that we need to meet energy demands in the future. They haven't even thought about this. And I don't even think they're competent enough to do it. But unless this is stopped, we are on our way to ruin. We really are.
Oh, absolutely. And the strange thing is in the middle of all this boom of green technology and green energy, Zero Hedge has been reporting that U.S. coal miners are all sold out for 2022. And in fact, they have sold all of their coal through 2023. And they're reporting that some of these power plants are actually short on their coal inventories. And so obviously the demand is going up and we need things like coal and fossil fuels. You know, it'd be nice if eventually we discover some way to make green energy both fuel efficient and cost efficient. But in the meantime, we've got to have other energy sources.
Well, nuclear energy would be a good answer. Yes. To a lot of the concerns of these environmentalists, which are grossly overstated, because atmospheric CO2 is not changing the climate. That's the sad thing about all of this. They have completely lied about this and manipulated data, like we said, to get this result. And it's just disastrous to what they're actually doing to the country. It's really a shame. And I wish there was something I could do about it as a single person, but I'm afraid it's a political problem and it's going to take us all collectively to force these people out once and for all and get the country back on track.
Well, you are certainly putting out great information, and I know that our audience very much appreciates that. You're certainly a fan favorite. Chuck, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, you're quite welcome, Mark. I'll be glad to help in the future.
Be sure to check today's show page for some information that Chuck sent us that clearly shows NASA and NOAA's manipulation of the temperature data. To put it in business terms, what they did was lower their first quarter earnings by claiming they made less money than they actually did. So the second quarter revenues suddenly looked like they were on an upward trend. Investors then think that the company is on track to increase earnings even more in the next quarter. That sort of thing would land you in jail if you did it in the financial sector, because people would be investing in a stock based on falsified and manipulated financial data. So why are we investing hundreds of billions in global warming and green energy based on falsified and manipulated temperature data? Wake up. It's your money they're using, and they're investing in Enron. Don't be silent. Demand accountability. That's what turned Virginia red. Because as we say every week, the best information is no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.